pulsating, perfectly calibrated whirring and spinning of cogs, and the pleasingly equal balancing of energies. Simple melodies are passed back and forth between the violins in playful repetition, rather like the push and pull of a pendulum. Part of the satisfaction of the Corelli style is that there is a predictability about its internal movement, and yet it's never tedious. In an age when the rich danced obsessively, you would be forgiven for assuming that Corelli's clockwork rhythms were, like Lully's ballets, destined for the stage or the courtly dance floor. But the surprising truth is that his chamber sonatas for just a few instruments, and in due course his concertos for a small string orchestra, were composed to be heard during church services. But what Corelli perfected above all was a form of musical contrast, an internal drama in the texture that was fresh, surprising, and for the time, highly original. To appreciate how radical his approach must have seemed, we should remind ourselves that the prevailing instrumental style of the first half of the 17th century had been consort music, that is, four or five strong ensembles playing gently soothing, mellifluous pieces, rather like an instrumental version of a choir, or what Shakespeare called still music. Indeed, consorts were generally made up of choirs, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, of the same instrument, typically viols or recorders, or later the violin family. Occasionally, these consorts were mixed so that a lute might join in or a recorder with some viols, but composers on the whole didn't specify which instruments they expected to hear or even whether the parts were vocal. They merely wrote generic consort music and whoever was around joined in. It was, in effect, a modular approach to music making. Appealing, though, this laissez-faire undoubtedly was, especially for amateur musicians, it resulted in instrumental music that didn't make great demands on players, their instruments, or indeed composers. There was no point in writing an exciting solo for a violin if the chances were that the part was going to be played on, say, a shawm, a wind instrument of sweet tone but dangerously limited range. Gradually, this attitude changed, prompted in part by the dexterity and showmanship of celebrated virginals and lute players. String and wind members of consorts began to liven up the texture of the music with ornaments, fast runs, trills, fast repeated notes, and fancy rhythmic figures. The jaunty patterns of popular dances were put together into contrasting groups of three to provide variation, slow, fast, slow, or fast, slow, fast, even when the consorts were not accompanying actual dancing. The graceful early 17th century consort sets of Charles I's in-house composer, William Laws, for example, create a triptych from the dances Fantasy, Pavane, and Almain, where the first and last are jovial and the middle reflective and sad. One great shift in consort music made by Corelli and his imitators from the 1680s onwards was to strip back its traditionally contrapuntal texture, that is, to replace its interweaving but independent voices with a more unified, streamlined sound, with the keyboard and cello locked together supportively, underpinning the sparring interplay of the two violins above them. But arguably the greatest aspect of Corelli's revolution was his approach to dynamics, the manipulation of loud and soft passages in music. In the 17th century, the concept of music gradually becoming softer or louder was technically difficult to achieve for many instruments, and in any case, it was not a trick it had occurred to composers to incorporate in their scores. A 17th century trumpet, for instance, was incapable of playing softly. It was more or less a case of on or off, whereas a pair of 17th century virginals was all but inaudible to anyone standing six or more yards away. Keyboard instruments were quite unique in that they had soft and loud settings, but no way of moving smoothly between the two. You could jump from a loud sound on one organ keyboard, or manual, to a softer sound on another manual, to create the impression of an echo, for instance, but it was virtually impossible to do so gradually. What composers could impose instead of incremental change were more abrupt contrasts of loud and soft, like the juxtaposition of light and shade, chiaroscuro, in painting. What Corelli did was create a musical version of chiaroscuro by contrasting a big-sounding band of stringed instruments with a smaller group, switching between the big and the small throughout the piece. The larger ensemble was called the concerto grosso, and sometimes the ripieno, the Italian for stuffing, and the smaller group was the concertino, little consort. They would play phrases in succession, one after another, three players alternating with, say, 20. The pieces in which Corelli developed this light and shade technique came to be known by the name of the larger group, concerto grosso, and subsequently the generic term concerto. Corelli's typical concerto grosso was divided into three sections of contrasting speeds, slow, fast, slow, or fast, slow, fast, after the fashion of the earlier consort suites or sets. Not fatigued by his radicalization of both musical texture and technique, Corelli added another flourish to his work, a musical shorthand called figured bass, or thorough bass, inherited from Monteverdi and universally adopted after him. Though it was intended merely as a time-saving tool, its use began to change the way composers and keyboard players manipulated chords, changing the sound of harmony along the way. It was as if text messaging shorthand, as used on mobile phones, were to shape the way language was written in books. Figured bass allowed composers to jot down a minimum of information on their scores, assuming that their players already knew what the jottings meant, and to dash off their compositions much more quickly and succinctly than ever before. Music copyists, printers, and engravers had much less to squeeze onto each expensive page, and, as an added bonus, it gave the players quite a lot of artistic freedom to do a bit of on-the-spot improvisation. What the keyboard player had in front of him or her were the bass line notes borrowed from the cello player and some extra numbers above it. That's all. And yet, this shorthand of numbers translated into a fully realised, harmonised, that is, with chords for every note, keyboard part for both hands. When I, the keyboard player, read the note G, for example, which has no number above it, I know I'm meant to play the straightforward chord of G, the notes G, B and D. If the G had had a 6 written above it, though, I would shift the top note, D, up one step of the keyboard scale to the so-called 6th note, from 5th to 6th, from D to E. Thus, I would play a slightly different chord, G, B, E, rather than G, B, D. Some notes had 2 numbers above them, for example, 7 and 6. This means that on each, I would replace the 5th note, first with a 7th, then with a 6th, making 2 different chords one after another. Sometimes the number is accompanied by what has been known for centuries in music as the sharp sign. We'd call it a hash on a phone. This tells me that of 2 possible chords allowed on this note, let's say it's B, B major and B minor, I should choose the one with a sharp, B major, rather than the one without. The sharp here clears up any ambiguity between the two. The distinction is offered wherever the default option for the chord might be unclear according to the key of the piece. This system of figures, which prevailed until the music of Haydn and Mozart in the late 18th century when composers began specifying the exact notes they wanted played, allowed composers to give their players a string of chords out of hundreds of possible combinations in quick succession. How the players chose to play those chords could alter from performance to performance. It's a rather non-prescriptive, jazz-like system in that respect. Indeed, figured bass was a style that every trained musician in Europe and the colonised New World understood and imitated, rather as every modern-day guitarist knows what is meant by G7 or blues in E. If you shape your music around a bass line with a series of chords, though, there's a hefty knock-on effect in terms of the sound you create, and the advent of figured bass marked a significant and clearly audible, even in Corelli's earliest works, break with the past. The progression from one chord to another became much more purposeful, and chords began to take on a life of their own. Since placing one chord after another in a random succession is not very appealing in any form of music, composers now needed to become much more aware of how to string chords together in a way that was neither haphazard nor ugly. The solution was harmonic progression. We've already witnessed the 15th century composer Josquin des Prez beginning to harness a sense of home or cadence in his choice of chords, and that this home could be moved around within a piece, within reason, to provide variation and movement. But while Josquin lived at a time when very few chords were considered wholesome and acceptable, the permitted harmonies had increased considerably for our 17th century composers. Vincenzo Galilei's guidelines for the approved use of dissonance, Discorso intorno all'uso delle dissonanze, of 1588-91, had introduced combinations of notes that would have sounded shocking and disturbing to Josquin, yet even Galilei was considered outdated within 20 years. The chords in Monteverdi's madrigals likewise shocked contemporary listeners, but his experiments in harmony showed how rewarding and expressive the interplay of chords could be. His successors pushed the boundaries of chordal harmony yet further, revealing powerful gravitational forces at work in the relationship between chords, and it's by experimenting with the juxtaposing of certain chords that they stumbled across harmonic progression. It could just as easily be described as musical gravity, and it's one of the most rewarding gifts in all music. Musical notes, as we've seen, are grouped in families called keys. Within these families, certain notes have more prominence than others, a hierarchy evolved from the natural properties of sounds in all resonant materials. In the 16th and 17th centuries, composers increasingly found that chords had a hierarchy too. Certain chords exert an influence over other chords. If, for example, we are in the family or key of G, the chord of G, the triad G, B, D, is home. The chord B minor, B, D, F sharp, is a close relation to G because it shares two of G major's three notes. It has two-thirds of its DNA, if you like. As we saw with Palestrina's use of closely related chords to create a soothing, ethereal sound, and Monteverdi's mischievous use of more distantly related chords to intrigue or surprise the ear, these relationships between chords could be potent elements in any composition. Composers discovered that some chords were drawn magnetically to others. Adding an F to the G major triad, G, B, D, made it yearn to move towards the C major triad, for example, of which more shortly. Others changed their character with the addition of an unexpected bass note beneath them. As well as a general drift towards more adventurous combinations of notes than before, composers of the 17th century now had figured bass to work with, and this encouraged them to experiment with the roots of chords. The root of the G major triad, G, B, D, is G because it lies at the bottom. But if you add a low bass note playing the note E, for example, the root of the chord shifts to E and the chord changes its sound. All triads are transformed in some way if the root in the bass line is not the same as the bottom note of the triad. This seemingly simple device hugely increased the chordal nuances available to composers, and they began constructing sequences of chords whose position was dictated by the gravitational pull exerted on them by the behaviour of the root note in the bass line. These sequences, once discovered, became bread and butter to the music of the late 17th and early 18th centuries and are still in use today in popular songwriting, particularly, as it happens, by songwriters who play the bass, such as Paul McCartney or Sting. Like that which cycles through Pachelbel's canon, these sequences were driven by the direction of travel of the bass line, giving forward momentum to the music, hence the name harmonic progression. Composers became so fond of certain chord progressions in the 17th and early 18th centuries that it was even possible for them to create the impression of chords when there was only one solo instrument playing a melody and no apparent accompaniment at all. What might be described as virtual or invisible harmony was conjured up by skimming up and down the constituent notes of a chord, for example on a solo violin, so that listeners assembled the chord in their heads. It was a kind of oral trompe l'oeil. A brilliant example of this occurs as the epilogue of Heinrich Biber's devotional cycle of 16 solo violin sonatas known as the Rosary or Mystery Sonatas, composed in 1676. Each sonata portrays an aspect of the Virgin Mary's or Christ's life, the Annunciation, the Nativity, the Crucifixion, and so on. And it ends with a piece for solo violin called simply The Guardian Angel. Although there are a few moments in this sonata where the player is in fact able to play two notes simultaneously by drawing the bow against more than one string at once, mostly we only hear one note at a time. Our ears, though, believe we have heard full chords, a whole accompaniment, from this one solitary instrument. It's partly a trick and partly the conditioning of our ears. Thanks to the vast musical catalogue that has used these same chord sequences time and again since the 17th century, we complete the sequence in our heads without it being spelt out. Bieber's Guardian Angel is an especially interesting piece because it's constructed in a format known as passacaglia, which divided moral opinion in the 17th century but continues to influence music today. The passacaglia structure involves a short sequence of four or eight chords repeated many times, which act as the springboard for a series of unfolding melodic explorations or improvisations. It's a template that would describe a vast amount of 20th century jazz too, although the term passacaglia has rarely, if ever, been used in that context. It derives from the Spanish prototype passacalla, meaning street steps, another example of the fashionable Italian term being universally adopted, which, coupled with the fact that it has a repeating bass line, suggests the form's origin lay in dance. Indeed, the passacaglia was also known by the name chaconne in the 17th century, and this most certainly was a dance form, referred to by the Spanish writers Miguel de Cervantes and Lope de Vega as a popular dance amongst servants, slaves, and the Amerindians of colonial New Spain. The term chaconne may come from the sound of the Mexican castanets used to accompany the dance. The chaconne dance swept Europe in the early 1600s with a popularity that bordered on a craze. It was deemed so sensuous and irresistible that some supposed it could only have been put on earth by the devil himself to tempt people to behave in a lewd manner. But over the course of the 17th century, the chaconne lost its wicked reputation and became a courtly dance, its repeated musical pattern increasingly associated with just one sequence of chords, over the descending bass line, for instance, G, F, E-flat, D. By the time Heinrich Bieber incorporated the chaconne sequence into his sacred devotional pieces in 1676, no one remembered the supposedly satanic origin of the chaconne, but they did remember the chord sequence, which is what allowed Bieber just to hint at it in order for the listener to hear the full chordal texture. Eventually, the dance elements of the chaconne were abandoned altogether, and the chord sequence alone remained in music of all styles and rhythms. The sequence has been among the most persistent in music history, its shape faithfully reproduced, for example, under the chorus of Adele's Set Fire to the Rain of 2011. Though the Rosary Mystery Sonatas weren't published in Bieber's lifetime, it seems unthinkable that J.S. Bach didn't know them when he composed his own set of sonatas, partitas and suites for solo violin and solo cello 40 years later, pulling off exactly the same oral illusion with silent chords. He too held the chaconne in high regard, composing as the final movement of his second partita for solo violin, a chaconne lasting an incredible 15 minutes, possibly written in memory of his late first wife, Maria Barbara Bach. It is one of the undisputed masterpieces of all music for the violin, comprising an astonishing 64 continuous variations on a single theme, creating the impression of an orchestra of sound from one single instrument. In the late 17th and early 18th centuries, there was one sequence of chords that composers loved more than any other. They all used it in virtually every piece, thousands of times in all. It's still in use today, though not quite so obsessively as back then. We have already witnessed composers beginning to play around with this sequence as they became aware of musical gravity, but in the dusty world of music terminology, it has a name, the circle of fifths. The circle, or cycle, of fifths works like this. You start with a triad on any note on the keyboard, say B, and you construct a sequence of chords by dropping down five white notes on each step. B, E, A, D, G, C, F, B, and so on. When the sequence first started appearing profusely in the late 17th century, the norm was to cycle through just three or four chords rather than the possible chain of 12. The sequence works by exploiting a weakness in the first of two chords. If you play a triad, for example G, comprising the notes G, B, D, you can make it vulnerable to change by adding the seventh note to it, in this case F, G, B, D, and F. Now, this triad of G yearns to move to the chord lying a fifth below it, C. Adding a seventh to C will make it yearn to move to F, and so on. You can find these virtuous circles of three or four and very occasionally five chords all over the music of Corelli, Vivaldi, Bach and Handel. What comes across in their work time and again is a relishing of the joys of chords for their own sake, the delicious transition from one to another and the effect it might have. Sometimes they dispensed with melody altogether and simply allowed a lovely chain of chords to unfold, as Vivaldi does in the opening Adagio e Spiccato section of the second concerto in his collection unashamedly labelled L'Estro Armonico, the inspiration of harmony. What may surprise you is that the dozen or so chord sequences beloved of composers around 1700, including the Circle of Fifths, are still the top dozen harmonic sequences mined by composers of all styles today. The chord sequence shared by Bach's Air on a G-String and Procol Harum's Whiter Shade of Pale is just one of innumerable examples. I can guarantee you that there is no chord sequence out there, however fresh its apparent sound, or however young and innovative its creator, that hasn't been thrashed into oblivion many, many times before. Playing around with musical gravity had one effect that no one quite expected. Since the time of Josquin des Prez, the growing reliance on chordal harmony, on locating a sense of home in the music and on exploiting the chemical reactions between different chords and different homes, had gradually been undermining the older medieval system of note families, the modes, which were above all ways of organising melodies rather than chords. In the late 17th century, the modes finally gave way to their successor, keys. While the modes adopted by folk music and by the music systems of other cultures, all melody-orientated, had a wide range of note choices in them, like a palette with 50 colours on it, the plain chant modes established by the European church were made up of a very limited diet of available notes. They had a uniformity and blandness about them, as if our palette now had fewer than a dozen colours. The limitation of both ethnic and ecclesiastical modes was that you had to stay in whatever mode you had started in for the duration of the performance. So, in the church's mode system, if you were singing a tune in, say, Aeolian mode, your given notes would be A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, all the white notes on a piano or organ keyboard. You would stick loyally to just those notes for the whole piece. This was a cosy, unsophisticated world where you didn't wander off mid-song to another home or mode. But it was also a pragmatic measure, since medieval instruments had a limited number of notes and generally only played in one or two modes. A penny whistle to this day has the same limitation. To play tunes in a range of mode families, you have to buy several penny whistles, each calibrated to a different mode. But during the 17th century, musicians intrigued by the forbidden fruit opened up by chord sequences increasingly sought to be able to move from one mode to another. If, for instance, you follow the logic of the circle of fifths sequence, you're forced to move into new modes whether you like it or not. Gradually, then, the restrictive modes were replaced by the more flexible system of keys, which allowed for a larger number of notes to be available at any given time. This was because, through the mechanism of the minor and major third that we encountered in John Dunstable's music at the turn of the 15th century, keys included in their dual scale, or palette, of notes that would, under the mode system, have belonged to separate modes. Thus, the key of E minor embraces 9 notes: E, F sharp, G, A, B, C, C sharp, D, D sharp. And the key of E major adds a 10th note, G sharp, in contrast to the ecclesiastical Phrygian mode's modest 7. What's more, the overlap of notes belonging to closely related keys made moving from one key to another easy. While it's not, strictly speaking, accurate to say that a minor version of any given key is sad and its major version happy, since there are notable exceptions, the ability to switch from one mood to another instantaneously and at will was a very big advantage of the key system over the older modes. Modes were one thing or another, the Ionian and Lydian being sunnier, like modern major keys, and the Dorian and Phrygian being darker, like modern minor keys. But a key could change its mind about its mood whenever it liked. The modal sound didn't disappear completely after it had been supplanted by the major and minor keys. It lingered at the edges of art music, popping up one moment in Chopin or another in Debussy. It never went away in folk music, so whenever composers were trying to sound rustic, earthy, or homesick for their native countryside, you could expect them to dip back into the modal well for inspiration. But for a trend-setting composer like Corelli, with his well-integrated string ensembles and his radical musical style, the modal sound would have seemed, I suspect, rather old-fashioned and like something better suited to street music. His music, joyfully and abundantly at ease with the new major and minor key palette, was a gateway to the extraordinary creative possibilities opening up with the new system. Corelli's influence in creating the new concerto style from the innovative musical ingredients of his day is hard to overestimate, not least because of the effect he had on a red-haired Venetian 25 years his junior, Antonio Vivaldi, whose L'estro armonico, Concerto Grossi of 1711, immediately established him as a genius of the first order. Its success also marked the moment when Italian-led movable type printing for music was replaced by the faster, more accurate plate engraving technique. Compared to the clockwork finesse and gentle charm of Corelli, Vivaldi introduced a sense of drama and virtuosity that took his contemporaries' breath away. In effect, he was turning his violinists and cellists into divas to rival the opera stars of the day, of whom he knew a thing or two, claiming to have composed 94 operas, of which only about 20 survive. It's estimated that Vivaldi composed in excess of 500 concertos for a variety of instruments, taking Corelli's big group, little group idea one step further by pitting a charismatic solo violin against the whole ensemble. This dynamic new style of solo concerto announced its arrival on the musical stage in 1714 with a set of concertos Vivaldi proudly unveiled as La Stravaganza, the extravagance, followed in 1723 by a set of pieces that were to become deservedly utterly ubiquitous by the 20th century. The first 4 concertos of 12 were called Le Quattro Stagioni, the 4 seasons, but the umbrella title of the collection perfectly captures the spirit of Italy's monumental contribution to 17th century music, Il Cimento dell'Armonia e dell'Invenzione, the contest between harmony and invention. The 4 seasons, as well as showing off the virtuoso capabilities of the solo violin, also explored the notion that purely instrumental music could be pictorial, or at least descriptive, in this case of non-musical features in the natural world. Vivaldi came up with musical effects to depict dogs, mosquitoes, a variety of birds, the hunters and the hunted, winter and summer landscapes, rivers, storms, and an assortment of rustic characters at play, all of them the imaginative result of experimenting with the various violin-playing techniques pioneered by Corelli, Bieber, and indeed Vivaldi himself at the end of the 17th century. Thus, chilly raindrops in winter are evoked by high violin notes being plucked pizzicato. The chattering of teeth is the high strings playing ultra-fast repeated notes, tremolando, and so on. Incredibly, the popularity Vivaldi enjoyed during his middle age didn't last. After living most of his life in Venice, he moved to Vienna in his 60s and died there lonely and impoverished. For the next 200 years, his prolific body of music would stay silent, his career forgotten. Almost. Vivaldi's legacy survived in the somewhat surprising influence he had on another very different composer. Vivaldi's Italian innovations, honed to sensuous perfection in the carnival city of Venice, travelled north across the Alps and found a fan in Lutheran northeast Germany, Johann Sebastian Bach. But it wasn't just Vivaldi who, musically speaking, migrated from the bustling Arcadia of Italy to the spiritual lucidity of the Protestant North. This phenomenon can be seen almost everywhere you look when it comes to the music of the early 18th century, and there is no neater demonstration of this process than in a subject close to Bach's heart, the invention of new keyboard instruments. What we now call simply the piano was invented in around 1700 by a Florentine instrument builder and restorer called Bartolomeo Cristofori. The unique selling point of the new instrument, distinguishing it from all the harpsichords, clavichords, spinets and virginals that went before it, was its ability to play soft and loud, or, in Italian, piano e il forte. Its main predecessor, the harpsichord, plucked its strings, like a harp on its side in a box, and the mechanism only allowed for a single pluck of uniform strength, thereby creating a sound that was always one volume. No matter how hard you pressed the keys, the sound had the same power. The only way of making a harpsichord louder was to have a double or triple set of strings that were plucked simultaneously, a mechanism that was, once again, either all on or all off. The only way of making it softer was to lay felt against the strings, also either on or off, and there was no way of moving gradually from one state to the other. Cristofori's invention, instead of plucking the strings, tapped them with a gentle hammer tipped with deer skin. Crucially, the harder you hit the key, the harder the hammer hit the string, resulting potentially in different levels of volume for every note. The piano was a musical revolution, but despite its ingenuity and novelty, it didn't catch on in Italy, whose intense relationship with stringed instruments, among them the harpsichord, was second only to its passion for opera. The piano, which, like the harpsichord, operated via an arrangement of tightened strings, was from the outset treated as a new species, an outsider to the string family of instruments. It took a German organ builder and friend of J.S. Bach, Gottfried Silbermann, to see the piano's potential and, with help and advice from Bach, to begin manufacturing pianos. Indeed, it was thought for many decades outside Italy that Silbermann had actually invented the piano. Such was the oblivion into which Cristofori's effort had fallen. It was around the same time that the piano's close relative, the organ, also mastered the art of volume control, thanks to a device called a ratchet swell pedal. This mechanism opened or closed shutters on a box containing the pipes, thus allowing organ sounds to get progressively louder or softer. In 1711, an organ was installed at the Church of St. Magnus the Martyr at London Bridge with such a pedal, thought to be the first of its kind. Although Bach played on a few of Silbermann's prototype pianos, he never expressed any great enthusiasm for them. It was his son, Johann Christian, living in London, who was to be the champion of the new instrument 30 or so years later, paving the way for the young Mozart and others to follow his lead. But Bach Pear was involved in a keyboard innovation that proved equally important to the history of music as the invention of the piano. It could, in fact, be the single most important invention in all Western music. Like nuclear fusion, it's not easy to explain, but it had an enormous effect. It was called equal temperament. It all started with a problem. The problem was that composers were outgrowing not just the old modes and the restrictions placed on them, but also the complicated system of tuning that allowed instruments to play in different keys. It was bad enough that many instruments found it difficult to play with each other and stay in tune, which was partly because they were not designed to be able to play in lots of different modes or keys, and partly because the materials they were made of, animal gut, treated softwoods, lightweight metals, made them, by modern standards, unstable in variable temperatures. In the 1970s, when the movement to reproduce authentic replicas of pre-1800 instruments was enjoying its early boom, orchestras discovered that it was virtually impossible for these replicas, or indeed the few originals pressed back into service, to stay in tune with each other for more than a few minutes. Recordings of, say, Bach on these instruments involved hundreds, if not thousands, of edits, splicing together countless snippets from numerous takes to fake the sound of a tuneful ensemble. This issue of tuning came to a head with the growing dominance of keyboard instruments in the 16th and 17th centuries. On a modern, equal-tempered keyboard, I can play in any or all of the available 12 key families, that is, major and minor versions of all the notes that lie between our Western octave, to my heart's content, and I can switch from one to another whenever I like. I can play any piece in any key without worrying that the piano or organ will sound out of tune when I move from key to key. I can also play any other instrument I like for as long as I want, within reason, without succumbing to the same worry. But this was not the case until the growing dominance of keyboard instruments in the 16th and 17th centuries finally led to a breakthrough in the first few years of the 18th. The adoption of equal temperament in Western music. In order to understand the importance and impact of this breakthrough, and indeed to understand what equal temperament is, we need to look back at what it swept away, which was, in effect, nature's tuning system. Why would 18th century musicians have wanted to do away with nature's musical laws? To illustrate nature's musical laws, we can use a piece of pipe or tubing. If you blow across the mouth of a length of tubing, you can make a musical note. This is the technology behind every flute, whistle, shakuhachi, or recorder ever blown in the history of humankind. Obviously, each length of tube only plays one main note, so if you want to play more than a one-note tune, you'll need to change the length of the column of air. A swanee whistle demonstrates perfectly that if you gradually shorten the length of air in the tube, the pitch of your note becomes higher and higher. As we saw when we first encountered the octave, if your column of air is exactly half the length of where you started, you'll get a note that is the same pitch, only higher. If you glide up the octave from bottom to top on a swanee whistle, however, all sorts of notes are revealed between the two, and every musical system in the world has subdivided the octave into formal, measurable positions along that scale. But not every musical system in the world opted for the same number of subdivisions. Much Asian and Arabian music has a larger number, as a result of which it often sounds exotic and out of tune to Western ears. The Western system had, by about 1600, settled on just 19 subdivisions between one note and its octave, and all of these 19 pitches were determined by natural mathematical ratios in the relationship between one string or pipe length and another. These tunings have been called Pythagorean, because it was the ancient Greek philosopher, mathematician, physicist Pythagoras who worked out the ratios for creating notes in music by dividing a taut chord and plucking it. These 19 subdivisions were easily singable or playable on stringed instruments because tiny differences of pitch can be achieved by allowing your voice to rise by minute degrees or by sliding your finger ever so slightly up or down the neck of the violin. But for keyboard instruments, on which the pitches of each step are firmly fixed, these 19 subdivisions were a nightmare. Two solutions were on offer. One was to build keyboards with the necessary fidgety subdivisions, which some people did. These 19-note-per-octave keyboards had to double up the black notes into a double-decker arrangement and squeeze an extra little black note between others. These keyboards were absurdly difficult to play, but not quite as deranged as the 31-note keyboard built by a Venetian called Vito Trasuntino in 1606, involving triple-decker black and white notes. He called it the Clave Musicum Omnitonum, All Tones Musical Keyboard. It did not catch on. More notes does not mean better music. The other solution was to reduce the number of divisions from 19 to a more manageable 12 and to fudge the swallowing up of the pitches that were left out. This meant, for example, the two separate notes, G-flat and F-sharp, were combined into one all-purpose note. One key represented them both. But this was not quite the brilliant solution it might have seemed, since F-sharp and G-flat were still, to stringed instruments, singers, and some brass players, separate notes, albeit just a short distance apart. If a keyboard played its G-flat while the violin played an F-sharp, it produced an unpleasant, headache-inducing dissonance. This grating struggle over where the pitch should fall affected most of the notes of the scale in one way or another. It was a bad state of affairs. All that keyboard tuners could do was plump for one or the other and squeeze the strings this way or that, so that, for example, key families using the sharps, that is, edging upwards in pitch, E major, A major, B major, would be favoured, while key families requiring the flats, edging downwards in pitch, would have to be avoided, which explains why moving between key families that had flats to ones with sharps was dangerous and disagreeable. And keyboard tuners were kept incredibly busy in the 16th and 17th centuries. Keyboards of all kinds had to be tuned every day, or at least before every performance, rather as harps or guitars must still be tuned for every performance today. Clearly, this wasn't satisfactory, either for keyboard tuners or composers, who were in practical terms restricted to certain keys. I doubt it was much fun for all the other instrumentalists either, who would not ordinarily have been bound by such restrictions. But why did it matter that G-flat and F-sharp carried on being separate notes, everywhere other than on a keyboard, or B-sharp and C, or B-flat and A-sharp? Why couldn't the violinists and singers forget they ever existed and toe the line? The reason is that the more precise divisions of the octave into 19 steps obey mathematical ratios that occur in nature. Let's say your column of air, your bamboo pipe, is of such a length and thickness that, when you blow across its mouth, the note produced is a pure, lovely-sounding B. Dividing the column of air by the mathematically perfect ratio of 2 to 1 will produce little b, an octave higher. Dividing that column of air by the mathematically perfect ratio of 3 to 2 will produce F-sharp. These relationships, and all the others based on mathematically straightforward ratios, are pure and perfect. However, if even just this 3 to 2 ratio is applied to all the notes in the scale, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and thereafter to all the perfect 3 to 2 ratio notes they throw up, E, F sharp, G, A, B, C, D, and thence the perfect 3 to 2 ratio notes they throw up, B, C sharp, D, E, F sharp, G sharp, A, and so on, you eventually end up with too many sharps and too many flats to accommodate, and this is before we worry about all the other perfect ratios. The upshot of all this is that it was generally considered a worthwhile compromise, for the sake of keyboard practicality, to reduce the number of divisions from 19 to 12, even though this omitted some of nature's purely produced notes. The next act in this drama had tuners artificially moving the pitch of some of the 12 subdivisions so that, instead of lying where they should, according to nature's laws, they were shunted into 12 equally spaced man-made positions between the two ends of the octave. It would be like reportioning the days, hours and minutes so that there were exactly 12 months of 30 days in every calendar year. It was this recalibration of pitch that became equal temperament or equal tuning. Although others had hinted at the possibility of evenly dividing the 12 notes of the octave, the first precise calculations of an equal temperament were made by Vincenzo Galilei in his Dialogo della Musica Antica et della Moderna of 1581, and by Zhu Zaiyu, a Ming Dynasty prince, in Lu Shui Xin Shu Wo, New Explanation of Musical Pitches, in 1584. Why these two dates are curiously close, given the geographical distance between Europe and China, is a mystery yet to be unravelled, but Galilei's and Zhu Zaiyu's calculations were the same. One worked out using lengths of plucked cord, Galilei, and the other with 36 specially made bamboo pipes, Zhu Zaiyu. The calculation showed that each string or bamboo pipe had to be 94.38744% of the length of the previous one in ascending order. The 12th rung would thus be exactly 50% the length of the first. Having the theory, though, did not lead to its immediate adoption as a tuning system in either China or Europe. In the West, it took another century of experiment and debate before this evenly spaced solution for 12, not 19, notes emerged as the front-runner solution. Gradually, over the course of the 17th century, all instruments were reluctantly persuaded to conform to the 12-note division of the keyboard, needing to be tuned before every performance to the pitches that best suited the keyboard. Though it was created in defiance of nature's musical laws, the new interlocking standardized system came with huge benefits, not least making all 12 key families compatible. Out of the chaos and confusion, the evenly spaced octave was born, and we have lived with that huge shift in Western music ever since. It was J.S. Bach who presented, in around 1722, the most conclusive evidence that a tuning system for all 12 keys could work. He called his system the well-tempered keyboard, landmarked forever in history by his composing two companion pieces, a prelude and a fugue, for every one of the newly adapted key families. Its first prelude is now very well known, and incidentally made up entirely of a chord sequence, no melody, exactly as Bach's hero Vivaldi might have done. Bach's well-tempered keyboard, which led to equal temperament, wasn't perfect, but it was a practical solution to what had hitherto seemed intractable problems. It's hard to exaggerate the importance of its arrival and adoption as a standard across the industrialized world. Like the adoption of the Greenwich Meridian, which made everyone perceive the map and their place on it in a new way, for better or worse, equal temperament altered the mindset of everyone who enjoyed music. The modern population of the world now hears all music through the filter, some would say imperfection, of equal temperament. Indeed, all of us alive today have a different impression of what sounds in tune or off-key from those alive in, say, 1600. The sense of order out of chaos that was ushered in by well-tempered keyboards would have appealed to Bach enormously. There is a fundamental logic at work in all he wrote that was not merely the function of a character trait, like people who simply have to order their bookshelves alphabetically, but rather a product of his deeply felt Lutheran faith. All you have to do is compare the atmosphere and architecture of an Italian church of the period, or even the Catholic south of Germany, with the kind of church Bach was familiar with in Saxony, to see how profoundly this difference of attitude might have affected every note he composed. Bach's Lutheran Christianity, unlike the papal Catholicism with which Galileo Galilei battled, was at ease with scientific investigation and the widening education of its laity. Indeed, it positively encouraged it. Though he might not have recognized the label, Bach's faith falls within the movement known as German Pietism, which reached its high watermark in his lifetime. Pietism laid great store by helping congregations find God themselves through personal acquaintance and knowledge of the scriptures, through humility, non-confrontation and piety, through an ethos of hard work and through education. Subsequent scholarship, notably Robert K. Merton's seminal 1936 thesis and 1938 book, Science, Technology and Society in 17th Century England, has helped establish the dynamic link between the scientific revolution of the 17th and 18th centuries on the one hand, and Anglican Puritanism and Lutheran Pietism on the other. For our purposes, it's enough to note that Bach, an inventive musician par excellence, was actively involved in the search for equal temperament, the development of the piano in Germany, and the design of state-of-the-art techniques in organ building, and yet saw no contradiction between the scientific and the religious aspects of his music making. On the contrary, his pietism embraced the relationship between God and science. For Lutheran pietists like Bach, illuminating the gospel was paramount, as were metaphors of light and transparency. Lutheran and Reformed churches were purged of decorative trappings, elaborate altarpieces, art that was potentially distracting, statues of saints, and the kind of ornate gold-leaf trinketry that sprawled across the walls of Catholic churches of the period, a style that is sometimes referred to as High Baroque or Rococo. Lutheran congregations were expected to be active participants in the service, with communal hymn singing given high status. A huge amount of what Bach wrote, including virtually all his 300-plus cantatas and his vast output of organ music, is based one way or another on hymn tunes, or chorales, as he would have called them. He would weave a tapestry of sound around a hymn being sung or played slowly through the centre of the work, as he does to majestic effect in Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, in which what appears to be a lilting dance theme is transformed by the stately progression across it of a German hymn chorale. To Bach, the point of music was to glorify God, to reflect upon, interpret, and celebrate the meaning and mystery of the scriptures. Because the Protestant Reformation had grown out of a sense of disillusionment with the corruption of the Roman Church, central to Lutheran attitudes was the importance and sanctity of law, uprightness, and thrift, and Bach's way of expressing this priority in music was through a technique we have already touched upon, but of which he was the undisputed master of all time, counterpoint. Counterpoint, to Bach, was the ultimate set of laws in music. Obeying these laws was for him something beautiful, uplifting, and reassuring. The quintessential Bachian form of counterpoint was the fugue. A fugue, which means flight in Italian, is a complicated form of canon or round, such as London's Burning, in which, as in any canon or round, the same tune is sung by different groups at different points, each new entry fitting on top of the others. A fugue is an extremely clever and essentially more grown-up version of the same thing. In a typical Bach fugue, such as the Jig fugue, the tune to be imitated would be much longer than the four notes that begin London's Burning. In the Jig fugue, the first part, or voice, though it's all played by one organist with the help of his or her extremely athletic feet, is then joined by three others, also carrying this tune. Some of the entries in the Jig fugue are in new keys. It starts in G major, but there are versions in D major, B minor, briefly A major, and also E minor, and some are upside down. That is, the tune leaps upwards in one version and downwards in the variant. Another fugal trick is retrograde motion, whereby the tune is played backwards against its forward-playing self. In some fugues, Bach introduces the incoming imitation at half or double the speed of the original, and sometimes he uses a number of these techniques at the same time in the same fugue in different voices. He truly was a master of the counterpoint form. As if to underline this, Bach created, but didn't complete, a collection of mind-bogglingly complex fugues, Die Kunst der Fuge, the art of the fugue, towards the end of his life. The 14 fugues he did finish all start with the same relatively straightforward tune, but then explore different options and techniques. As a whole, it is a vast, miraculous musical jigsaw, never since matched by any composer. Bach could layer 3, 4, five or even six simultaneous parts on top of each other, all using variants of the basic theme. Die Kunst der Fuge includes such showpieces as mirror fugues, which invert their first half laws during the second half of the piece, and which could operate on up to six different levels. The original melody, which Bach called rectus, straight, would have its backwards variant, inversus, laid on top of it in the second half. The home of the melody would reverse the relationship between its voices so that five notes higher became five notes lower. The key movements would likewise switch so that a modulation, change of key, in the first half moved in the opposite direction in the second. The order of voice entry would be reversed from, say, bass, tenor, alto, soprano to soprano, alto, tenor, bass. The chord sequences would run in the opposite direction during the second half. And finally, the cadences, coming to arrest chords, would be approached from opposite directions in the reflected mirror of the piece. Constructing musical scaffolding as complex as these fugues would be hard enough to achieve with the whole map of it laid out in front of the composer on the manuscript page, like an empty crossword to be slowly and painstakingly filled in. The staggering fact is that Bach could improvise fugues like this at the keyboard, and often did. There's a story about Bach as an old man being summoned to the court of the young King Frederick the Great of Prussia, a major patron of the arts and a trained musician himself, to show off his skill at counterpoint, by then deemed an old-fashioned and largely redundant skill. The king had his court musicians, one of whom was Bach's son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, devise a tune specially, one they mischievously knew was practically impossible to turn into a fugue without creating horrible dissonances. Bach sat down at the keyboard, one of Frederick's brand new Silbermann pianos, and improvised, on the spot, a three-voice fugue to this apparently impossible theme. The king, his guests, including the music-loving Russian ambassador, and his in-house musicians were flabbergasted. But not as amazed as when the king received, a few weeks later, a written-out fugue, or Ricerca, based on the supposedly impossible theme, this time in six parts. The Italian term, Ricerca, means, appropriately, to seek again, and Bach even titled his musical offering, Das musikalische Opfer, with an acrostic in which each word of the title starts with a letter from the term Ricerca, Regis Iusu Cantio et Reliqua Canonica Arte Resoluta, theme issued by the king with additions resolved in the canonic style. This six-part Ricerca is still to this day considered by musicians and composers the greatest, most complex feat of counterpoint of all time. Bach's interest in counterpoint, though, was not about putting haughty monarchs in their place, nor about solving puzzles and codes for the sake of it. He believed what he was doing was the musical embodiment of God's master plan for humankind, a recognition of the intricate mathematical beauty of the natural order as ordained by the Almighty. Counterpoint was a manifestation of Lutheran pietism in music. In the towering achievements of his career, his sacred settings of the trial, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, he brought to fruition every piece of the musical toolkit then available to him to address what was to him the deepest and most powerful mystery of all. Two of these epic settings survive: the Passions according to St. John, 1724, and St. Matthew, 1729. The St. Matthew Passion, a work divided into 68 movements for orchestra, choir, and soloists, and which lasts over 3 hours, probably 4 hours in Bach's time, is one of the crowning creative achievements in all European culture. At its heart lies one supreme government, the Lutheran hymn chorale, with its simple, memorable tunes for the congregation, another of the central pillars of pietist doctrine. At the climax of its monumental opening chorus, with two adult choirs and a double-size orchestra already in full sway, Bach introduces a new, majestically slower tune on top of the entire structure. Like a phalanx of trumpets announcing the arrival of a mighty ruler, it is a children's choir singing a hymn chorale, O Lamb Gottes unschuldig, O innocent Lamb of God. There are few moments in all music as dramatic, as unexpected, and as moving. For Bach, this breathtaking moment of musical shock and awe is not music for music's sake. It's a manifestation of divine intervention. But for all this, Bach's passions don't feel like the beginning of some new movement. He was no pioneer, despite his brilliance. That mantle fell to his sons, Carl Philipp Emanuel and Johann Christian, who broke new ground and paved the way for Mozart's generation. Bach Sr., instead, synthesized all the musical styles around him to create his huge cathedrals of sound. From the music of Lully and François Couperin at Louis XIV's court in France, to Italian concertos and oratorios, and the church music of his North German predecessors, such as Heinrich Schütz and Dietrich Buxtehude. Composers at the very cutting edge of change are rarely the ones whose music lasts longest. Posterity eventually rewards those, like Bach and Handel, who can absorb and repackage the currents and fashions of their times, giving the resulting collage a distinctive voice of their own along the way. For the first 100 years after his death, though, Bach was a forgotten, unperformed composer. If he'd written operas rather than church music, it might have been a different story. Opera composers have always attracted more immediate fame, or notoriety, than church composers. Luckily for his great contemporary, George Friedrich Handel, opera was his thing, to start with, at least. Bach and Handel, two musical giants of the 18th century, were born just 80 miles and 4 weeks apart, and yet they never met. Though there are similarities in their idioms, particularly when it came to sacred music, they chose quite different career paths, which inevitably transformed their styles. Bach stayed firmly grounded throughout his life within the Lutheran tradition and the region of Thuringia, Saxony, where he'd grown up. Handel was the more adventurous pan-European traveller, learning his craft in Italy and then, in his 20s, settling for good in England, where he was to create the great body of his masterpieces. Indeed, his arrival in London in 1710 coincided with the completion of Christopher Wren's St Paul's Cathedral and Thomas Newcomen's invention of the steam engine in Dartmouth, potent omens of Britain's coming status as a world power. That a recently arrived talent like Handel should find himself plunged into composing for royal occasions of great pomp and prestige was impressive enough. His birthday ode for Queen Anne, Eternal Source of Light Divine, 1713, manages to sound regal, ethereal and gracious all at once, whereas the utterly thrilling coronation anthem Zadok the Priest, 14 years later, cracked superpower pomp in one master stroke, proving Handel had adapted to the indigenous choral style, as epitomised by Henry Purcell, as if he had been born, like Purcell, under the very shadow of Westminster Abbey.